Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special fundraising edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. When it comes to investing and saving money, a lot of us seek the advice of professionals to make and grow investments. Spending money is another thing, from buying groceries to splashing out on a car. Spending is more habitual, immediate, intuitive even, and we rarely feel better about it afterward. So what are we doing wrong? Elizabeth Dunn and Michael Norton are two rising stars in the field of behavioral science. They're co-authors of the book Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. And the book presents new research that upends the old axiom, money can't buy happiness, proposing that if it can't, you must not be spending it right. The book is now out in paperback. And Elizabeth Dunn, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your book is broken down into five key principles to teach us happier spending. Let's go through these. The first principle is buy experiences. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, the idea here is that people consistently get more happiness from buying experiences like trips and concerts and special meals than from buying material things, from couches all the way up to houses.
But trips and concerts and meals, though exciting and adventurous, can also be expensive, right? What's the difference?
Well, they're expensive often, and they tend to feel frivolous, right? Because you buy a couch, you're going to have that for 10 years. You buy a vacation, it's over in a week. But ironically, research suggests that the pleasure of that experience can actually last longer than the pleasure that we get from, say, something long-lasting like a couch. The thing is that experiences tend to bring us closer to other people in a way that material things don't. And experiences also make good stories. You're liked more if you talk about your experiential purchases than if you talk about your material purchases. So over time, experiences actually seem to provide higher returns in terms of happiness than material things.
And experiences like what? Going for a walk even? Going to a movie?
Well, going for a walk is a nice, cheap experience, but often we can use money to buy an even better experience, you know, going for a walk as part of an African safari, for example, or, you know, spending less money, but say, going to a movie, going out to dinner with a friend. Often we make trade-offs. You know, I've had friends who said to me, oh, well, I really can't go out at all for a month because I'm trying to save money to buy a new car, for example. And I actually think that that's not necessarily a good trade-off. I think although we feel like buying experiences might be a sort of waste of money, in fact, it seems to be one of the best uses of money in terms of delivering long-term happiness.
How about these big purchases, though, that adults make? One, of course, that people go through is buying a house, certainly an experience, but any data on how that stacks up emotionally?
Well, amazingly, even though buying a house is kind of like the quintessential aspect of the American dream, it turns out that homeownership really doesn't do much for our happiness. There's not a big difference between homeowners and renters in terms of happiness. Once you control for other sort of important variables like income, what you see is that homeowners weigh a little more. They're about 7 pounds heavier than renters on average, but they're not any happier. So it suggests then that, you know, putting all of our money into a home, particularly when that means, say, not being able to go to movies with your friends because you're house poor, you've put all your money into your house, well, that might not be such a great trade-off when it comes to happiness.
Okay, let's move on to the second principle to happier spending. Make it a treat. Now, what does that mean?
Well, this idea was actually inspired for us in part by comedian Sarah Silverman.
Oh, she's from New Hampshire.
I know. And she's a favorite of mine. And she has a saying, make it a treat, that she tells all of her comedy writers. So she finds that, you know, her comedy writers on her television shows that she's worked on want to indulge in all kinds of really gross jokes. Mm-hmm. But she says, no, you have to make these gross jokes a treat. You can't use them constantly, or they're no longer as funny. They don't deliver this kind of emotional punch. And the same turns out to be true with our spending. If we always indulge in things we like, you know, not just gross jokes, say, but lattes or fancy smoothies or whatever, those things that, you know, should be a treat tend to kind of fade into the background, and we start to indulge in this sort of habitual spending that no longer provides us with as much happiness. So we would argue that people should turn their favorite things back into treats by actually having them a little less often.
All right, let's get on to the third principle, buy time. How does one buy time?
So this is one that's near and dear to my heart. And the idea here is that when you pull out your wallet, you should stop and ask yourself, how will this purchase change the way I spend my time? And I would argue that many of our purchases, things like a new pair of shoes or a really nice purse, have little bearing at all on how we spend our time. And so I would suggest that purchases that are not going to affect our time may not be worth our time. And so instead, I would suggest that people focus on using their money in ways that will actually improve the minutes and hours of their daily life.
All right, what's an example of that?
Well, I think a great example is a dog. So if you're deciding between buying a dog versus buying a goldfish, the goldfish is clearly the cheaper option. It requires a lot less of your time. But a dog, buying a dog and putting all that money into having a dog, will change the way you spend your time. So you're basically committing yourself to spending lots of time, you know, walking the dog outside, which we know is good for your happiness, connecting with, you know, neighbors who, you know, have dogs who your dog runs up and sniffs, another thing that's good for happiness. So having a dog fundamentally alters the way you spend your time in ways that we know are actually good for your happiness.
Okay, so all of those mere minutes I could spend admiring those shoes on my feet doesn't mean much of anything?
Well, you know, I don't think we should completely discount that, right? So as long as you really make those shoes a treat and continue to appreciate them, then that's great. But often many of our purchases do sort of fade into the background and they don't really change the way you're spending your time. Now, if you don't have a pair of shoes, so you can't go outside because you have no shoes, then those shoes are going to make a difference in the way you spend your time. But buying that 12th pair of high heels is not going to change whether you're able to, you know, go out with friends on a Friday night.
Number four on your list of principles to spend more happily is pay now, consume later, the opposite of our credit-driven consumption market. So what does that mean? Avoid the impulse buy?
Well, the idea here is that we basically want people to do exactly the opposite of what they normally do. So very standard consumption pattern in modern life is that we, you know, get whatever we want right away and often pay for it much later. And we suggest people should do the exact opposite. So pay up front and delay consumption. And the idea here is that this way you get the pain of paying out of the way up front, which is good because it can kind of restrain our spending by making payment painful in the moment. That can keep us from overspending. And then by delaying consumption, we can reap a lot of free pleasure in the form of anticipation.
Elizabeth, your final principle to happier spending is to invest in others. What does the research say about how this works?
Well, the research suggests that instead of spending money on yourself, you can actually get more happiness by using it to benefit other people, whether that means donating money to a charity that you care about or just treating a friend to dinner.
What's an example of investing in others that doesn't necessarily mean a huge expenditure?
Well, I think the most remarkable finding from our work is that spending as little as $5 on a given day on somebody else can make a difference for our own happiness. And in fact, remarkably, we see this effect emerge all over the world. So we've conducted experiments not only in Canada and the United States, but also in places like India, Uganda, and South Africa. And what we see is that in some of these countries where people are really struggling to meet their own basic needs, we still find that people experience greater happiness when they use their money to benefit somebody else. So, for example, one participant in Canada told us about, you know, treating her mom to, I think, a scarf that she bought at the mall, while people in Uganda told us about things like buying malaria medication for a friend who was dying. And, you know, on the surface, these just seem like so different that how could we possibly see equivalent effects? And yet what we see in both countries is that people are getting more happiness when they're using their money to benefit somebody else.
Elizabeth Dunn, thank you. Feels like time well spent.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Dunn, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. She is co-author with Michael Norton of the Harvard Business School of the book Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. It is now out on paperback, and you'll find more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so the research shows that spending money on experiences leads to a happier life. Consider how many experiences you've had with public radio. Maybe you've sat in your car just a bit longer to hear an interview on word of mouth, or read a book because of an author that you heard on Fresh Air, or told a friend you have to listen to this story from This American Life. NHPR strives to provide you with a meaningful listening experience. Support the radio that you've come to rely on during NHPR's fall fund drive. Now is the time to do it. And thanks.
Hi, I'm word of mouth producer Logan Shannon, reminding you that if you'd like to give right now, you can call 1-888-805-6477, or you can go online to nhpr.org. And thanks.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout the world, hundreds of caves have been discovered that contain artifacts and paintings from prehistoric times. Werner Herzog explored one of the most famous, Francis Chauvet Cave, in his documentary, Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
These images are memories of long-forgotten dreams. Is this their heartbeat or ours? Will we ever be able to understand the vision of the artists across such an abyss of time?
The artwork found in these caves has provided a glimpse into prehistoric culture, but anthropological archaeologist Margaret Conkey says they only tell part of the story of early humans. For her project, Between the Caves, she's pushed archaeological research beyond caves into the landscapes where Paleolithic people lived and thrived. Margaret Conkey is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley. Margaret Conkey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Tell us about the significance of the name of your project, Between the Caves.
Well, we all know that cave people, cavemen, of course, have been part of a stereotypical notion of what our prehistoric past might have been like. And indeed, it is based, in fact, that there are caves that were occupied and used and excavated, and they're wonderful locations for excavation. But of course, there were many things that prehistoric peoples did that really were not in the caves. People did not live in the caves on a year-round basis. They moved about from resource area to resource area, and for social and cultural reasons as well. So our project was inspired by the idea to think about what people did when they weren't in caves, where they went, how they got their firewood, how they connected up with other people for mating, for cultural and social reasons. We have a number of archaeological sites which indicate that large groups came together at least occasionally to exchange mates, to socialize, and expand their networks of trade and exchange and society. So we decided, well, how are we going to find out about these? So we took an area in the foothills of the French Pyrenees, somewhere between Toulouse and the Andorra, charted out a triangular, rectangular area, and with a very well-known cave at the eastern end and a well-known painted cave at the western end, and just set out to find out what we could find from the fields, the open fields that had been plowed off and on over the millennia by farmers, to see if there were any traces. By now, we've collected over 6,000 artifacts dating to the Paleolithic period, some of which go back to more than 100,000 years.
You mentioned that your research has revealed clues to Paleolithic societies gathering, meeting with each other. What else does it reveal about how they migrated or survived?
Right. Well, we know that they were mobile, that mobility from season to season or region to region was definitely a way of life. But we also know they had amazing long-distance contacts. And actually, this is well established from the very beginning of the occupation of Europe by anatomically modern humans, where we find shells that are only coming from the Mediterranean way into the western part of Europe. And we find shells and other things, shark's teeth and so forth, from the Atlantic that are found hundreds of kilometers away. And we know right at our site alone at Peira Blanca, we're finding uses of flint, which is a raw material that can be characterized and identified as coming from 200 kilometers to the north. So we know these people were moving, objects were moving, people were moving, And along with that, of course, ideas were moving, culture was moving, social relationships were really the ties, literally, that bind and held a small group societies together over many thousands of years.
One of the things that you identified in your finding is a suggestion of sites called places of many generations, which just seems so evocative and wonderful to me as a term, and I'm wondering what that means.
Well, what we've taken it to mean is that in our survey, walking these cornfields, these vineyards of a beautiful part, I must say, of southern France, we have often found in the same location artifacts that are characteristic and well-known and accepted by archaeologists as being attributable to the handiwork of Neanderthal populations, which were in the area from maybe 100,000 years ago to maybe 35,000 years ago. And on top of those, or mixed in with them, we find artifacts that are characteristic of anatomically modern humans who moved into the region probably around 35 or 40,000 years ago. And so what we see is that even people of different biological groupings with different stone tool making traditions are visiting and using and being at the same location. And, you know, these people were well aware of what kinds of artifacts individuals or other groups were making. And so it's interesting to think about anatomically modern humans coming to a place, looking at the ground and seeing the remains, the stone tools left by not just, you know, their grandparents, but if they knew them, but by a whole different cultural and biological and technological group. So, and then we do see that through the Upper Paleolithic, which is what we call the period related to anatomically modern humans, that is between, say, 35, 40,000 years and 10,000 years ago, and even into the Neolithic after that, we see continued use of some of these locations by people making slightly different kinds of stone tools. So it just makes us think about what was significant about these places, and was it even just the presence of previous people that made them an interesting and significant place to be?
Margaret Conkey, you mentioned the sort of old image of cavemen or cave dwellers that has stuck in our imagination. And we often do think of early humans as other, very, very far removed from modern humans. What does your big picture research reveal about human nature, the way we communicate, move, and express ourselves?
Well, I think the work, especially in the time period and the locations where we are working, as well as in others, for ourselves, anatomically modern humans, shows quite clearly that we use the material world. We imbue meaning into materials. These people were making all sorts of objects out of bone and antler. They had created a visual culture, something that provided a link for them between themselves and the spiritual worlds, which surely they engaged with. They had hopes, fears, anxieties, anger, and warm feelings, just like we do. They were very, very successful for many, many millennia, which is maybe more than we're going to be able to say about ourselves in the long run. And I think that we have tended all too often to limit our understanding of their lives and experiences to the what we think of as the available information, the available archaeological data. So caves and hacking out stone tools and spearing animals has tended to be a kind of a limited understanding of what these people were all about, when it's clear from their abilities to move around a landscape, to know their resources. And when we see what they could do with materials, they knew how you could use ochres and manganeses and how you could use bone and antler. They knew the principles and properties of materials in ways that I think few of us actually understand. So I think what we need to do is remember these people were like us. They had these broad human experiences that led to the kinds of rich human experiences that have evolved and radiated outwards since their time.
Margaret Conkey, Professor Emerita of Anthropology at UC Berkeley, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and here at Word of Mouth, we found that the most interesting stories and ideas get passed around, well, by word of mouth. Maybe not spoken over a table or a telephone as they used to be, but by today's word of mouth, emailed to a friend or posted on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. And here's something we'd like to share with you. Your support for NHPR allows us to explore the world in ways that add context and accuracy and understanding. Help us keep those stories coming your way with a contribution to NHPR during our fall fun drive. And thank you.
I'm Word of Mouth producer Logan Shannon reminding you that if you'd like to give right now, you can call 1-888-805-6477. And you can, of course, go online to nhpr.org. Thanks.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last week, 55% of Scottish voters said no to independence from Great Britain in an historic referendum. While pro-independence activists were deflated by the loss, in New Hampshire, Scots spirits were high. Over the past weekend, some 20,000 people gathered at Loon Mountain for the 39th annual Highland Games. They ate haggis, they drank drams, they saw trees thrown and rocks hoisted. NHPR's Sean Hurley was there and brought us some scenes from the games.
The Laird of McIntosh is coming, McCrabby and McDonald's coming, McKenzie and McPherson's coming, all the wild McCraw's coming.
The McIntoshes and the wild McCraw's and 60 other clans are set up in a mall of white tents at the base of Loon Mountain. Tartans and coats of arms flutter above books of genealogy. Clan recruitment areas, says Dick Nickel of Clan McNickel.
What we do is we actively recruit anybody who is of the same name. Our clan is small, so we have all our names kind of look alike.
Nickel runs off a short list of eligible clan names. Nixon, Mickle, McRickle.
So far I've had two pay money to join the clan.
Nickel waves over his clan's high commissioner, Murray Nicholson, and points at the eagle feather in his cap.
If you walk around and you see people with caps on and feathers in their cap, yeah, it's very important. The average Scotsman won't have any feathers. If they have three feathers, they're a chief. If they're two, they're a chieftain.
Who's the only person in the world that gets to wear four feathers? Well, it's the Queen. Because she's the chief of chiefs.
The Lincoln police move through the crowds in kilts, ride segways in kilts. There's music like wind from every direction, talk of Scottish independence, and the tough salt smell of haggis, cockaliki, bridies, and rumbledy-thumps. Master of Ceremonies David Webster is considered one of the world's foremost experts on the Highland Games.
I did my very first games in 1937. My mother took me to Braemar Games, where the Queen attends every year, and I went there. Then I became an instructor in the Army later, and organized the Highland Games there. And from there on, I just became very interested in the games and have gone all over the world, Japan, every continent I have done it.
Webster wasn't in Scotland for the recent vote, but managed to vote by proxy.
I voted for remaining with the Union, yes. It was very, very, right up to the last point, I think, it was still in doubt. How I could put it is, if you vote from the heart, you'll have voted for Scotland to be free. But if you vote from your head, you know it's not the right thing.
Quick, march!
Dr. Bill Crawford from Concord, director of athletics for this year's games, provides a brief history of this gathering of the clans.
The clans would get together so that they could trade and maybe set up a marriage. But Scots being Scots and Celtic people being Celtic people, they also would include games. There was dancing and bagpiping and music, and also athletics. The oldest game that we know of was called the Ceres Games in 1320 after the Treaty of Arbroath, and they had stone lifting and caber tossing.
It's a chilly day to throw poplar trees, and Crawford says the cold is affecting the athletes.
So now they're doing the caber toss. This caber is about 19 and a half feet long, weighs about 140, 145 pounds, but it's all in the palm of your hands, and then you run with it. And then you try to throw it straight up in the air and get it to turn over. It's quite a feat.
Iceland's Heidar Germundsson struggles to balance the telephone pole-like caber in his palms, as David Webster narrates for the crowd.
Yes, I see, Gerd Rundberg, or something like that.
I can't see it. Nobody can see it. It's a tongue twister.
Well, actually, his name is Heiðar Geirmundsson. But we call him Heisi.
Heisi!
That's it. Thank you very much indeed, Magnus.
Heisi, who can trace his ancestors back to a Viking king, runs 20 yards with the caber and throws it. But Heisi can't get the caber to flip over. Eight giant men in kilts, including Heisi and Hafþór Björnsson, one of the strongest men in the world, stand in a tight scrum around a freshly made hole in the middle of the makeshift arena. A 56-pound iron ball thrown high in the air during practice for the weight-over-bar competition has just disappeared into the earth. A shovel is found, the grass dug up, and a broken sewer grate discovered. And there it was, the yellow-painted ball, some 5 feet down a narrow drainage pipe.
No way any of us are fitting down there. Who's the skinny, tall guy?
Who's the skinniest one?
The giant men briefly look at me, the closest small person available. It's like the scene in The Hobbit, where the mountain trolls are getting ready to eat Bilbo.
You!
Grab his ankle!
But then the closest small person is rescued by an even smaller person.
I got a kid!
Hold on. What are we going to do? He's
got an ankle.
Yeah, he grabs it with two hands. He's fine.
Suddenly, one of the athletes dives into the hole. His ankles are grabbed at the last moment as he slides face down and recovers the weight. The Mountain, as he's called in Game of Thrones, Hafþór Björnsson, likes his brand new kilt.
I think it's awesome. It fits me well, and I look pretty awesome in it.
The Mountain is 6'9" and weighs 400 pounds and is my height while sitting. After the most recent World's Strongest Man competition held in Leeds, which he won, he declared, "I am the future of strength, and I am the king of stones."
I am the future of strength!
I ask the future of strength, the king of the stones, what he'll be doing in today's competition.
Well, I'm gonna try for a new world record in stone carrying, and as well I will try to throw a weight over bar.
MC David Webster describes weight over bar thusly.
Like throwing a 56-pound boy over a double-decker bus.
Hafþór will be throwing the ball recovered earlier from the hole. And as it turns out, he soon finds himself on the verge of a world record, not in stone carrying, but in weight over bar.
This is out of this world. They're going to put it at 19.2 for a new world record.
Hafþór swings the chained 56-pound ball with one hand, like a pendulum between his legs, and prepares to loft it up and back over a goalpost behind him.
He's never done this, right?
No, he just learned how to do this when he was out here.
The Mountain stands on the mountain and composes a tweet. Today I throw higher than the current standing Highland Games world record, weight over bar. Standing in line to meet the Mountain, a woman says the new Outlander TV show is Game of Thrones for girls. And the Outlander fan watches as Game of Thrones star Hafþór Björnsson lifts a girl over his head and smiles for a photo. The Icelander, an Outlander, no more. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.